everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that will make you feel all right, but cannot legally call itself Dr. Feelgood. There are reasons. We'll not get into that right now. I'm Dave Babbitt.
I'm Andrew Kanigeiser, and basically our new co-host is with us. Who do we have with us?
It's me, James Rivnak.
Yes. Dave, who are we, and what are we doing with everybody's time this week?
Why, this is Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, throw it under the microscope, look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. The important thing is that each and every week, the film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed on the preceding week. And yes, this is our 150th episode, folks, of the show. Regular episode. We've done 12 bonus ones. But the important thing is that, Andrew, where were we last time and where have we ended up?
Last time, I tagged along while you guys were big fans of Screamers, which kind of wasted a great Peter Weller performance, and more regrettably, wasted a tremendous performance by Roy Dupuis. that being said, we decided to follow editor Yves Langlois to another action film featuring another uncannily amazing francophonic language performance. We decided to go to, I don't even remember the year, it's Highlander 3, The Sorcerer, aka Highlander, The Final Dimension, Highlander, The Final Conflict, and Highlander 3, The Magician, directed by Andrew Morahan, in a cast featuring Christopher Lambert, Deborah Kara Unger, Mario Van Peebles, Mako, and Martin Neufeld.
Yeah, now, if this film's from 94, I'll put it this way, I forgot to add that into the notes, but let's be clear here, folks. Yeah, this will mark Christopher Lambert's third time on the show at this point here. I think at this point we've covered Harvey Keitel once.
Are you counting the time that you guys lost Highlander 2 because of me?
Yes. Funny enough, we don't often try to line up certain milestone episodes, or at least numerically significant ones, all that often. But we kind of did this time because we famously have one lost episode, and that was Highlander 2, which I think was the first time James had ever been on with us.
Yeah, it would have been.
Yeah, and it was a tremendous conversation, a hilarious conversation, like, I think really one of the best episodes we ever did. And then what happened?
It somehow got lost between me, I don't know, trying to save it after, or exporting it, and then it disappeared into the ether.
Yeah. So our first major snafu was because of James over Highlander. So to celebrate episode 150, James now has the opportunity to redeem himself and our show also with Highlander.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, like, if I can merge myself with, like, a mother box of some kind, I can then pull it out of the internet.
Well, as they say in the business, there can only be one, but there may be a second chance. That being said, Highlander, the series, well, we recapped it once, but you cats at home didn't hear it. I think it's safe to say that Highlander, even at its most successful, has always been a very cult franchise.
Yeah. To put it mildly.
Like, I mean, it's not successful on the same tier as, say, your Terminators, you know, contemporaneous action franchises, and yet Highlander kind of endures, much like the Immortals that form its plot. But speaking of plot, though, I think there's a good number of people that may know a thing or two about Highlander, but certainly not Highlander 3. So I think that's the opportune time for me to throw it to James to tell us what we're
going to
do.
I think we are going to have to get all on the same page, as it were. And to do that, I believe Dave is going to open the first chapter of his new book, The Rundown.
Highlander 3, The Sorcerer, which has also been released under several other titles, is the 1994 entry in the action fantasy series. Ignoring the events of the second film, the Sorcerer finds series hero Connor MacLeod drawn back into the battle to be the only immortal left alive after the villainous immortal Kane escapes a mystical cave which has kept him locked away. Directed by Andrew Morahan, and starring Christopher Lambert and Mario Van Peebles, the film was a critical dud upon release, but a modest box office success, thus ensuring two further sequels in the franchise. Coming up after film strips, Jim Belushi guest hosts an episode of Sci Factor.
Here we are, born to be kings. We're the princes of the universe. No, not really, but that was a famous line from the movie Highlander, which we are not talking about, but we are talking about Highlander 3. But I guess it behooves us, Dave and Andrew, to give a little context around the Highlander film franchise, such as it is.
If I may, James, behooves or beheads?
Oh, well played, sir. Now, is my memory just like that good, or was that conversation from when we talked about Highlander 2 so riveting that I still remember it? Or have you talked about Panzer and Davis on this show before?
No, that was the only time we've covered Panzer and Davis. But yeah, they are I will put it this way. As of a few months ago, we no longer have Davis as well. So now they are both gone. May they rest in peace.
Or rest in pieces.
Oh, I guess there can't be one after all.
Well, I will say I'm just trying to be nice up front because I don't know how nice we're going to be for the rest of this.
Dave, you worry too much about the feelings of famous people who are never going to listen to our show.
Well, they're dead, of course, but they have, you know, estates. They have relatives, presumably.
counting on them to tune in. I love your optimism. It is indeed the beating heart of our show.
Hey, look, let's not forget that apparently the account for Victor Mature run by his daughter favorited a tweet from our show once, so I'm standing
Told me that, or maybe you did, and I forgot, because I forget the conversation about these producers, so I'm glad, James, you had the foresight to ask Dave about it first.
I'm just waiting for Wilhelmina and Panzer to retweet this episode.
Fair. But yes, okay, so yeah, let's go back to the early 1980s we'll try to do the quick version of this. Okay. So there was a university student by the name of Gregory Wyden, who at the time was writing his thesis script for the program he was in, which was a little thing called, would ultimately be titled Highlander. This leads us to Peter Davis and William N. Panzer. Now, these were producers. They had made things. In the words of Clancy Brown, many not nice things that he has to say about them. And yeah, if you look over their history and track record, I would say that these are producers who barely seem to be able to hold any production they were involved with together. Sort of dangerously close to predatory, I would say, in many ways.
Aside from, like, prior to Highlander, what would be, like, a big film they had done?
The Osterman Weekend is probably the most famous one, which was Sam Peckinpah's final film, which also, I believe, was a notorious disaster on set.
And that kind of gives me a sense of just sort of what tier of producer we're dealing with. And I think I understand.
Yeah, so the big thing is they picked up the script. And again, Clancy Brown actually tells a really good tale recently about how what ended up happening was they picked it up with the intention of making like this low-budget thing. They happened to throw an offer out to Sean Connery thinking that he would turn him down flat out. Instead, he said he would do it provided they pay him this much money. So the budget got amped up substantially just to get Sean Connery and other people on board, which effectively turned it into a real movie. Yeah.
Well, let's not throw the word real around too much. I mean, after all, you have to remember that the first Highlander film is technically a canon picture.
But at the same time, not every canon picture has Sean Connery. It didn't all have Queen doing a soundtrack for it.
It's true.
And it didn't have an opening sequence featuring Michael Hayes and the Fabulous Freebirds, especially when he does a finger-wagging dance while giving somebody a headlock. But you also have Clancy Brown, who we had seen previously in John Dies at the End, and probably something else. And you have the star, though, who's probably the smallest stature in terms of enduring popularity, Christopher Lambert, a.k.a. Christopher Lambert. I say Lambert, whatever.
Yeah.
We know who we're talking about. Yeah, and so it's almost like I rewatched the first Highlander recently, and you almost get a sense of a film that succeeds in spite of itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. Like, I mean, I've read what I believe was the early draft by Whedon, and it was a very different beast from what ended up on screen. His was a much darker sort of philosophical take on this. It wasn't really aiming to be an action movie as such. Under Panzer and Davis's guidance, that changed very quickly. And the thing was, you know, while it wasn't a mega hit in America, because it was effectively an international co-production, it was a huge hit across the rest of the world. And in the process, and in that being the case, they were actually able to secure, you know, the deal to put together a sequel to the movie. Now, if you've seen the original Highlander, again, the quick rundown. Immortals, no idea where they come from, but they're all battling it out, and they can only die by beheading each other.
Well, yeah. And I mean, Dave, I think an important distinction for Highlander and sort of why it appeals to, you know, maybe a nerdier kind of film goer, though, is like, it's not quite Shogun Assassin, you know? It's not just somebody with sword going forward and mowing down bad guys. Like, it's not quite an action movie the same way that a lot of sort of C-Ro kind of pictures really are. Like, mm-hmm. It's not to say that
there's
it's terribly
a hefty
deep,
fantasy
like,
element,
yeah,
too.
There's a strong lore that then gets expanded upon, and that's sort of where the series really starts tripping up. But it sort of has a bit more of an attention to world building than something like, say, Conan, which we watched previously and also had Mako.
Yeah, now
in so a similar role.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. So Highlander, it ends with the big things you probably remember is that there can be only one, because the whole point of Highlander is that ultimately everybody's gonna, all the remaining immortals will meet up at the Gathering. They will end up fighting it out until there's only one left, and that person will get some sort of nebulously defined prize. They're not entirely sure what it is. And lo and behold, by the end of that film,
it's
the winner is
gift card for $15 to JCPenney.
That would honestly probably make a lot more sense than most of the suggestions in the various different Highlander continuities.
Well, exactly. I mean, you don't need to go crazy with a fan theory when you think about how good a dependable pair of comfortable pants will serve you.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. But that film ends with Connor McLeod, yes, played by the very not Scottish Christopher Lambert here as the victor. He wins the prize. He gains mortality there. He apparently, based on the implications of the ending, can have telepathic powers and understand everyone. That part's a little unclear, but yeah, the film ends with him going off with his soon-to-be wife to live out the rest of his existence and die. Doesn't leave a lot of room for a sequel necessarily. Now, if you're a savvy person, you might turn around and sit there and say, well, naturally you make a prequel, wouldn't you? Panzer and Davis did not have that kind of foresight, however. No. So, with absolutely no involvement from Whedon, they basically end up deciding to create a straight-ahead sequel. They bring back director Russell Mulcahy, famous for his music videos and for doing, I think it was Razorback was the big, Killer Boar film that he yes. did in Australia originally. And, yeah, they all come back with a massive, massive budget this time. I think it was around $40 million or so, with the intent of making a... it was a big amount of money that they got a hands of. Now, you might sit there and say, two producers with barely that much experience and some shady business practices and that kind of money. That can't end well, right? And oh boy, you're absolutely right. It could not end well, but in spectacular fashion. Because basically Highlander 2, The Quickening is a film where anything that could go wrong went wrong, from choosing the exact wrong country at the exact wrong time to film in, inflation causing script pages being removed, the film not finished being shot, the Bond company coming in and finishing the movie without consulting anybody.
Speaking of Clancy Brown anecdotes, apparently they did at one point approach him to return and reprise his role in some capacity, and they lowballed him on the offer, and he said words to the effect of, look, I'll be in a good film for no money, and I'll be in a terrible film for a lot of money. I'm not going to be in a terrible film for no money. No.
Yeah.
And it's like, you have to respect that.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, Clancy Brown, like, he has been very vocal over the years about how much he disliked Panzer and Davis. From there. And from the sounds of it, yeah, a lot of people have had less than stellar dealings with Panzer Davis. And the thing is I highly recommend watching the documentaries on the making of Highlander Endgame and Highlander the Source, because it is literally like watching an episode of The Office where Michael Scott is completely oblivious that he has no idea what he's actually doing here. And everybody's just sort of looking uncomfortable. It's like, are they being serious? Really?
Oh, yeah.
Are they going to pull this off?
Speaking to that notion, though, it's like there's a lot of people who end up saying no to Highlander 2. And so the people who end up saying yes, I mean, you got Michael Ironside as the villain. And while he gives a tremendous performance, it's not quite sequel villain of the same stature as, say, like Terrence Stamp in Superman 2. You know, it decidedly feels like a bit of a downgrade. The same way that you get a lot less Sean Connery, and instead you get John C. McGinley artificially lowering his voice for some reason. And like, there's this weird sense of an expansion, while at the same time, like, a cheapening across what becomes Highlander 2.
I think you guys are also burying, like, the lead on this one, which is they didn't know where to take it, so they created a brand new backstory that the Highlanders, or the Immortals, that's what they're called, only one of them's a Highlander, are aliens from the future in a planet called Zeist, where they have been, they've been exiled because they tried to start a revolution?
Something like that.
So they were exiled to Earth, destined to live as immortals until, I guess, they get their heads cut off.
Yeah, it's like Phantasm 2, but it takes itself a lot more seriously.
And so a lot of people, when that movie was, I guess, released into theaters in, what was that, 1990?
Yeah.
90, 91, somewhere around there. A lot of, like, I mean, obviously, you can probably guess from hearing the description of of the plot and its production that it received pretty negative reviews and, I believe, tanked.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, negative reviews to the tune that it frequently appears on lists of, like, biggest either disappointing sequels or box office disasters. So, yeah, lightning did not strike twice here.
Although I would like to point out, for those who believe that the Snyder Cut is a new revelation, Panzer and Davis would actually go forward a number of years later, complete additional shooting to restructure and recreate Highlander as the Renegade version.
Mm-hmm.
Russell Mulcahy had zero involvement in that re-edit.
Which, well, I thought he did.
That's the thing. Apparently he didn't, from what I understand. It was the producers at their behest. That's why it's not called a director's cut. That's the thing. It's a little up in the air, and it's hard
Some
to know who to believe.
Some directors are renegades, though.
That's
like
true.
Like Steven Spielberg.
But point of the matter is, it's somehow a film which, on one hand, you would think maybe they can fix it somewhat. Somehow they make it even worse by making the backstory even make less sense than the whole they're aliens from another planet thing. Point of the matter is, it's universally reviled, and you would think, yeah, that's probably going to put a fine, stake through the heart of the Highlander franchise.
Where do we go from here? Well, actually, it turns out we're making a third one.
Well, before we get there, there's actually another little detour, and that's called Highlander the Series, and it's kind of important to understand. Because Panzer Davis decide, well, okay, fine, we can at least create some sort of syndicated television version out of it. And yeah, sure enough, they go out of their way. It becomes a Canadian-France co-production there. And I believe it's shot like half the time in Vancouver and half the time in France there. They actually brought Christopher Lambert back for the pilot to sort of do a passing of the baton on to the series hero, Duncan MacLeod. And the thing is
here
the
you
series...
go, Adrian Paul. Take my sword.
I am from Scotland.
Well, this is the thing. They made certain key choices, like actually hiring a Scotsman to play a Highlander in the show. But I mean, the thing is, it takes place in an alternate continuity where, yeah, the first movie happened, except it wasn't The Gathering, so don't ask about that. It's just, we're carrying on. And I will say, I have not watched every episode of Highlander, the series, by any stretch.
I'm surprised by that.
Why not,
you
Dave?
Should.
Come it's on. Not,
it takes away from his Doctor Who time.
Indeed. But I will say that it's actually, it is a show that's actually not bad. And basically, not because of Panzer and Davis, from the sounds of it, basically everybody else who worked under them did everything in their power to make the show actually worthwhile.
Okay.
And yeah, it was a show that actually developed a really decent cult following. It had people like Roger Daltrey and Joan Jett guest starring on
it,
including its opening villain, played by the one, the only, Richard Maul.
Bull from Night Court?
And Two-Face on Batman the Animated Series. Also, exactly. It doesn't count if Joan Jett shows up. It doesn't mean it's good, because after all, she don't give a damn about a bad reputation.
Fair enough. But yes, in this instance, so that show launches in 92 and gradually becomes sort of a cult favorite and a big enough success it'll end up running for 6 years. First run syndication. And again, it's, you know, it sort of resurrects a bit of the goodwill that people had towards it. So much so that Panzer and Davis decide, yes, they're going to take another crack at doing a Highlander film.
Yep. They put their keys in the Highlander machine and they turn them at the same time and it opens up and there's a big bag of money with the Roman numeral 3 in front of it.
I thought you were going to say they put their keys in their Toyota Highlander.
No, that would be a bit more dependable than one of their productions. Now, I did it.
Film strips brought to you by Toyota.
Friend of the show, Toyota Canada. You can depend on them. Domo arigato. Indeed. I understand. I don't know the full extent of it, but I gather this film also had a tumultuous production. Namely, I understand there were two fights. At one point, Christopher Lambert walked off set because he was unhappy with something. And that's a bad sign when he's like the connective tissue across the films.
When you've upset Christopher Lambert, you know something's wrong.
Exactly. He's like, this is beneath my talents. You know, then apparently there's a backstage fight between Mario Van Peebles and the band Guns N' Roses.
Which is my absolute favorite
yeah,
anecdote about this movie.
And then apparently Russell Mulcahy is involved with the project, and according to Dave's notes, ends up not being involved with the project and gets sued for $9 million.
Okay, yeah, so let's back it up.
Like, how does one get to that point? Like, that's where we are before this film even comes out.
Yeah, okay. So basically, yes, in this instance, the film is near as I can tell. Panzer ends up coming up with a new screen story, quote unquote, alongside Brad Mehrman for Highlander 3. And the writer ends up being hired is Paul Ohl, hopefully I'm pronouncing it correctly, who is a French writer who I'm going to admit I have not seen any of his other works. But the point of the matter is they end up getting financing again from Canada, France, and the United Kingdom in this instance. Somewhere along the lines, because what you'll notice when you're watching this thing is that while Panzer and Davis are noted as presenting this movie, they are not actually credited as producers. Instead, the one you're going to find here is Claude Leger. I'm probably botching the pronunciation of that. A French producer, and apparently something about the financing agreement was to keep Panzer and Davis completely away from this project. Normally, I would say that was probably because they seen what had happened beforehand and understood that there's no way in hell we can trust these guys with this kind of money. But instead, from the sounds of it, Ledger also ended up having some creative accounting issues on this movie as well on his end. So make of that what you will. I can neither confirm nor deny any of this. This is just what's floating out there in the weeds. Yes, Russell Mulcahy was apparently approached about coming back to direct this third film, supposedly verbally agreed, then backed out, probably because he realized, why would I go through this a third time with these people?
And filmgoers everywhere had a similar response a little while later.
Yeah. But, yeah, so in this instance, yes, he gets sued, and instead, somehow they end up landing on director Andrew Moorehead. Now, this is actually one of the things I will say, on paper, kind of makes sense when you consider where Russell Mulcahy came from.
I'll go you one better, Dave. I will throw my marker down. I think this film works much better than it should, precisely because Russell Mulcahy is not directing it. especially, like, learning about Highlander 2 and, like, hearing his interviews on the subject, he is a guy that does not seem to actually have an accurate perspective towards his own work. And, like, there's a very emblematic moment in one of the commentary tracks where he simultaneously points out, oh, this shot was dreadful, like, here are all the things that went wrong, and then there's a pause, and he's like, still, it's there on the screen. And it's like, I don't think, like, I think when you're dealing with Highlander, there's an inherent silliness or, like, Rob Liefeld style comic cool about it that's always there. And I think it's a lot more enjoyable when you lean into it. And so Andrew Moorehead, being a music video director, is well acquainted with distilling that look. None of the scenes are overlong, because even the longest scenes are the length and cut like music videos. Mm-hmm. And as a result, this film, even though it's not good, it is not dull. And I think that's really why I like this film so much better than the second Highlander film, and indeed so much better than a lot of the other films we've watched recently. I would probably say Screamers is a better film than Highlander 3, but I enjoyed watching Highlander 3 a lot more.
Interesting. We'll get into this as we go. I can't say I 100% share your perspective, but I don't entirely disagree either. So we'll get into the nuance of that. The important thing is, he comes on board. Now, I don't know whether these actors were cast beforehand or not, but cast in the role of the villain of the film is Mario Van Peebles. Many people might know his father, Melvin Van Peebles, who is probably one of the more influential independent filmmakers of the 1970s, and yes, would be
a little thing called Sweet Sweetback.
Yep, and in the case of Van Peebles, he had been acting for quite a while, including in a little film called Jaws the Revenge, which we absolutely cannot forget is out there. So he's casting the villain, and Moorehead apparently is hellbent on thinking it's like, okay, we had Queen in the 80s do the soundtrack for the original film there, and they had a bunch of different rock artists do the soundtrack for the second one, including Stuart Copeland doing the actual score. So in this instance, we need to get another rock band to come on in and do rock music, because that's just part of the Highlander mythos. Hey, I'm on board with that. Not bad. Mm-hmm. And what does he think about doing? Well, gunning for what was arguably one of the biggest acts of the 1990s, which was Guns N' Roses. Now,
well, maybe the biggest acts of the early 1990s.
Yes. I mean, well, we are firmly in 1994, and Moorehead had directed a number of videos for Guns N' Roses, including was it November Rain, like one of the most like epic music videos of like the early 90s. Well, it's interesting that they would go after Guns N' Roses at this point, because they were tour. I am a big Guns N' Roses fan. Sorry, but like
1991 versus 1994
exactly
is pretty different, like, despite being a relatively short period of time in terms of their mainstream popularity.
Yes, like not only was their mainstream popularity sinking because of like the rise of grunge and stuff like that, but also they had been touring nonstop for a couple of years and were like breaking up as a band almost nightly. Like they're
as a public figure, Axl Rose really started becoming Axl Rose.
And it just seems to me odd to try to court a band that is on an unstoppable path of self-destruction.
But at the same time, the idea is, well, they're on the downswing, so maybe we can get them for cheap.
Can you guys come to Montreal?
Yeah. Well, police there don't ask questions.
Or maybe they do. I don't know. I don't speak French.
Je ne parle pas. Have fun. Keys are under the mat.
Well, supposedly...
Bienvenue à Montréal, indeed. The film ends up being shot in Montreal as well. And keen-eyed viewers will know that New York is not New York.
Yeah. But the important thing is, yes, they reach out to Guns N' Roses. They offer, and apparently, at the very least, Axl Rose was all on board for doing this, which was great up until a little detail was dropped on him, which was that Mario Van Peebles is in the film. To this date, nobody has been able to explain why, but apparently Axl Rose hates Mario Van Peebles. I don't know what happened. Nobody seems to know what happened. But he refused to be involved as long as Van Peebles was involved, and apparently Morahan thought it would be better to have Guns N' Roses involved than Mario Van Peebles, and apparently lobbied to actually remove him, to which the producer staunchly refused, probably realizing, yeah, that would be the kind of thing that opens them up to a lawsuit. And nobody wants anybody looking at the books on this movie. Trust me. So in this instance, yeah, that doesn't end up happening. But yes, sure enough, they go ahead and they start shooting in Montreal, Morocco, and in Scotland. Mostly in Montreal in this instance. Mm-hmm. Apparently, yeah, there was some fight where, I guess, Lambert, there was some pay dispute, I guess is why he was walking off at one point. Yeah, and
a Bond company, once again, gets brought in to finish the film. So it is plausible that there were difficulties with the finances on this production.
Yeah, now what makes it even more fun is that, and again, the distribution of this film ends up in a variety of different hands. I believe this was in Canada. Here was Alliance Atlantis, or that was the company that it's now become E1 in more recent years. But at that point, they were handling distribution in Canada. I think there was a few different international distributors, and in the United States, it ended up in the hands of Miramax. Now, this was notable only because, number one, the film didn't end up seeing release in the United States until 1995. And apparently once...
Yeah, so imagine this being their summer blockbuster follow-up, riding high off that Pulp Fiction money and that Cannes Award, and then dropping Highlander 3.
But it's
hilarious to me.
What gets even better is the fact that they decided to edit it down to a PG-13 cut in the United States and release it, which means that probably the most memorable scene of this film was deleted. We'll get there. But eventually it was finally released on home video in its uncut director's form. But even having said that, this movie technically exists in a variety of slightly different edits with slightly different music cues and slightly different effects work and different ADR dubbing at different points.
I think I watched the most complete version, and apparently the markers are whether it plays just the riff from Dr. Feelgood and whether or not you actually see a spoiler Kane's head roll off at the end of the film. Okay. And the version I watched did have both of those.
Did mine. Mine was called The Sorcerer on screen.
Yes.
Yeah. Supposedly, Morahan insists that the final
thank you,
dimension...
Public Library.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just like to thank the good people at E1 for lying on their back of their DVDs, because let me read this to you here. According to the format of this, it is in 69, 2.35:1 aspect ratio. It isn't. It most certainly is not. It is.
I don't know what that means.
That's means
like widescreen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Proper widescreen.
Yeah. Instead, what we get is a VHS rip in full frame on
the
screen.
Nice.
Which, I mean, like, if you're going to watch this movie, that's probably the best way to watch it.
What? That's exactly how this film needs to look. There is, like, a graininess to the VHS-like kind of quality. I love how this film looks.
I
do, too. I mean, I'm full-on nostalgic for that era.
Yeah. See,
a lot of that is visual nostalgia. But, you know, like, even just, like, the level of effects. You get, like, the classic... Remember when everybody discovered lightning effects in 80s action movies? Like, I'm thinking Masters of the Universe, Conan, this movie. There's always that scene where somebody summons like a field of lightning around themselves. But it's sort of that tier of effects work as well all throughout the film. So it does feel like a much older movie than it is, like, chronologically. It does not feel like a film you would have seen in theaters in 1995 in America.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Now, I personally would like to see this film actually released in a proper restoration on Blu-ray, or at least get dumped onto it by Mill Creek. I will say that, yeah, my original experience watching this film was asking my grandparents to tape it for me, because they had cable off of City TV at like 1 in the morning. Can you just
That's
please
where you dump this.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's where, yeah, it does feel very appropriate for this film. But yeah, I used to scour TV
Well,
Guide a lot.
that's the benefit of Canadian co-productions, because you can always play it on Showcase. At least back when it was good. Oh, nostalgia is a funny thing. But again, this film, though, much like the first one, which it deliberately tries to sort of emulate and like consciously mimic in its beats and some of its plotting, it ends up being more like the first one than you would think. Also, in the sense that, not by a huge margin, but this film at least makes its money back. And also, much like the Snyder Cut, is regarded as, well, at least it's an improvement over the last one.
And I will say this, yes, this film was enough of a hit to ensure that there would be another sequel 6 years later, and what
Yeah,
or
see you in 50 episodes.
yeah, and trust me, I was the geek in high school who was like, no, I am really excited for the next Highlander film. What about
Oh,
Star
boy.
Wars? No, I want to see the next Highlander movie. And yeah, I did see it in
Ugh.
theaters. So
Well, now whenever you look up like grossed 6 million at the box office, you can point and be like, I was there. But yeah, according to the figures I found, this film ends up coming in for like 30, 32 million, and it ends up making back at box about 36. So
Just
again,
eats by.
not a breakaway success, but given that the second one is known for being a terrible movie that lost a ton of money, this is one of those cases where, yeah, like even squeaking by with a tidy little profit is enough to lionize the producers and be like, okay, we're back, baby.
And this, I mean, like, this is the kind of movie that really deserves to find its audience or on home video. Well, right, like it's it may it, it this may have well have been a straight to video production.
Yeah, and it is a successful one if you
Absolutely.
think of it as a straight-to-video production. It just happened to also get a theatrical release.
Yeah, and I think that's the one of the things we need to emphasize, that Highlander fans, look, they are diehard in ways that I can't even begin to really fully understand. Like, they pull up with anything, and yeah, they buy stuff. And I'm not gonna lie, I went to a couple fan boards, which are, yeah, just about as dated as you can imagine in terms of their fonts and layouts. They're like just one step above
Wait, there's
GeoCities.
multiple fan
Yeah.
boards? I
Yeah.
thought there would just be one.
You would
Says the
think.
fans of Doctor Who and Michael Mann. And I mean, everybody has their own slice of fandom. And what I find fascinating, though, is that you could be into the most esoteric or requiring like lateral thinking to even get into as a premise. And then anything you're on the outside of, though, you look at it and you're like, I don't see it, man.
Yeah.
And I am not a Highlander fan either, the same way that people who aren't into Star Trek, like, it makes no sense to them. The difference being that I think it's more justified that people look at Highlander and go, wait, what? There's something inherently bonkers about Highlander as like an absurd premise, but there's enough at least gestures towards like that world building, that it sustains a certain level of fan interest over time.
Indeed. Which I guess behooves us to get into the film proper at this point.
Yeah, yeah, because this film answers whereas the second one stumbled with the question, well, where do we go from here now that the story's been told? This one doesn't ask that question. Instead, it does the opposite and says, hey, last one didn't happen. Here we are, watching
Born
Christopher
to be Kings.
Lambert. Yep. Here's our man, who... I love how the film, like, for a reset for viewers, they're like, see this guy? This is Highlander. Yeah. They refer to him as Highlander for, like, the first 10 minutes of the film before they refer to him as Russell Nash. Or... Connor McLeod.
Connor yeah. McLeod of the Clan
We
McLeod.
Get a very haggard-looking Christopher Lambert, who gives us some voiceover narration, basically recapping the events of the first film.
It's the, I believe it's the same narration that Sean Connery gives at the beginning of the first one.
It's
Isn't it? Yeah. At least it starts the same, right? Like, we were here silently moving down through the centuries, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Notably absent from this sequence, Sean Connery.
Well, I mean, to be fair, he did die in one and two.
But yeah, they noticeably don't even cut so that, like, it's not just him, it's also Clancy Brown, because when they show the scene of Ramirez, Connery's character and Connor McLeod's mentor, getting killed by the Kurgan, played by Clancy Brown, they noticeably use the
Isn't
shot...
Isn't it where we see from the back of him falling off a cliff? So,
Yeah, it's exactly it. You do not see their faces. So they're very much, it's that old school, we're cutting around what we can legally show here, and
That's
I
right.
miss that era. But yeah.
It's like in Superman 2 when you see a lot of the back of Gene Hackman's head.
Yeah.
I love the logic, though, where because they don't show the face, like, you know, even if they were taken to court, they're like, nope, we totally filmed that with the stand-in. They're like, are you sure? Where's the proof that we didn't?
Yeah. Well, now, so what ends up happening here is, yes, basically the film opens. We get Connor explaining that, yes, he was killed, became immortal at that point in time, was trained by Ramirez. And then sure enough, the Kurgan went ahead and killed his mentor and
Kurgan.
Yeah, and then he lived out the rest of his time with his wife before leaving, and as he states, basically wandering the globe. And this is where we get into this film proper, where for reasons that are unclear, he ends up in Japan. And
wait a second, though, if he talks about the Kurgan and he ends up killing the Kurgan in present day New York, and indeed much of the film is set in present day New York. How does the opening narration square up the fact that this is happening like 300 years prior to any of that happening?
Wait, what?
Right? Because if he's talking about, like, you know, the Kurgan defeated everyone, and then I defeated him and won the
prize. See, that's
then,
the thing. Okay, yeah, that happens in
that happens at the beginning because, of the film, but he's sitting in a cave continuing his training that we see with the sorcerer Nakano.
Yeah, that's the whole point. Like, basically, yeah, he Kurgan kills Ramirez, he wanders off, they don't meet again until 1986, so the Kurgan just disappears.
But he talks about winning the prize in the narration, and that only happened in the present.
Yeah, he talks about that having happened.
So why
later
is
on.
He in the past talking about the future, David? This is the kind of thing that normally drives you crazy.
He's
but it
not
makes
in
no
the past.
Sense anyway, because he couldn't have won the prize in 1986 because Kane was still out there.
We're gonna
and,
get to
and,
that.
And why doesn't he even mention that? He's like, where were you 8 years ago?
Yeah.
And see, that's why this film works. I'm trying to prove a point here, gentlemen, because from frame one, this film is not at all interested in laying out, here's what everything means, here's how it all works together. It's just, what is this film about? Okay, turns out there's another immortal, he's got a bad attitude, and turns out that Connor has to go fight him. And the film writes itself scene by scene around that premise. And this literally is a shut your brain off and have fun kind of movie.
Okay, yeah.
Because if you try and approach it as a serious thing, literally the first thing that this movie does breaks its own logic.
So, yeah. So what ends up happening here is, yes, Connor wanders in to Japan and ends up somehow meeting another immortal by the name of Nakano. Now, here is where, basically, yes, we get reintroduced to one of our favorites here on the show, Mako, who apparently, yes, it turns out, now, here's the thing.
Have we seen Mako, though? RoboCop 3,
yep.
Columbo, Murder Under Glass,
yep. Conan.
Conan the Destroyer?
The Barbarian. Conan
the Barbarian.
Yeah, the Barbarian okay. We covered. Yeah, so we've covered him three times, so welcome back Mako for your fourth appearance, and welcome back Christopher Lambert for your third. But yeah, it turns out that basically Connor is, the way it's framed, it almost seems like Connor is going to see him on purpose. Oh,
David, sorry, there's another third time appearance.
And that is?
Following Highlander 2 and The Life Aquatic, The Bond Company.
That's true, yes. Good point. But yes, in this instance, Connor ends up meeting up here. Whether he was seeking out Nakano or it's just one big pure coincidence, who knows? But yes, Mako...
He's seeking him out, presumably to learn how to fight with a sword.
Well,
despite the fact that he's been doing so for a couple hundred years at this point.
Well, at least a few decades, and certainly Ramirez trained him pretty well, so...
But also, Nakano is a master illusionist.
Yes,
a sorcerer,
okay.
If you will.
Yes.
Ooh, there it is.
Or a magician, depending on which territory you watch this in.
Yes.
A skill that will prove in handy during the final conflict.
Okay, so... So this is one of these things where, again, in terms of expanding the mythos around immortals, this is both, okay, it doesn't break reality quite like Aliens in part two, but it's still, it's like, oh, and by the way, apparently I mastered the art of illusion, as he puts it, which how this works and how it functions, we will never find out.
Gentlemen, you would say that he uses his illusion.
Turns out that later in the film Kane uses your illusion too. And we do see one thing that this film shows that you can do with illusion: terrorize a small boy.
Yeah, we'll get there.
So it's good for one thing, but yeah, we basically get the Dagobah sequence to start this movie, an extended montage of like quasi-philosophy while we see Mako sword fighting with Christopher Lambert, and then eventually we get the "your training is complete, in order to take the rest of my knowledge, you now have to cut off my head." Because I guess Nakano is a Highlander. Are Highlanders all immortals? Anywho, it doesn't matter. Cutting off his head will give the rest of his power in accordance with the quickening.
Yes, because, yeah, and that's the thing. Like, so they're establishing that, yes, there is this transfer of knowledge with the quickening. Something that...
And power.
Yeah, which we kind of assumed from the previous
films. It also happens quick.
Yeah. Yeah, but basically Nakano is also pointing, when Connor refuses to do it, Nakano's very happy about this, but he also lets him know that we got to be careful because there's a great evil wandering about the land, and that is Kane, played by Mario Van Peebles, who I don't think they ever properly establish where he's from. I mean, again, he's basically...
No, but he's got that cool septum ring. And I mean, just like in wrestling, you don't need to know where they're from. You just need a guy going, "By God, it's Kane," and you're hooked.
Yeah.
He at the very least made a stop through Mongolia.
Yeah.
He's basically your typical warlord of the era. But also, it's very quickly established as well. Christopher Lambert, he came here to act. He is acting on all cylinders, and it is the most amazing thing in the world. He doesn't look, he glowers. He doesn't have like a glance of eyes with things. He stares holes through them, and everything he does, even in these scenes, it's just like Mako, who we love, this old soft-spoken man at this point, and it's like, "You must cut off my head." "No, I will never behead you. I will never use violence." And it's like, okay, but you already have. And this guy's being like, you want to use your illusion one and two? It's up to you, man. He says no, but somehow, shortly thereafter, Kane shows up and says, yeah, I'll take some of that illusion.
Yeah, which leads to, number one, the hilarious, it is not your time, Highlander, get out. Which, of course, Connor sticks around and makes, like, I always love when they show old your Connor in his young days, because it's just a constant getting killed and swords rammed through him all the time.
Yep.
Like, every film is like this. But, yes.
Oh, no, I've been murdered by this man.
But yes,
it's really, after a point, Christopher Lambert can very easily turn into Strong Bad.
Yeah.
Oh, my clavicus.
But yes,
you guys know.
Congrats to our six remaining listeners to this episode.
But yes, but Connor gets Nakano chases and tells Connor to get the hell out of the cave and decides to hold Kane at bay using his power of illusion to make two other Nakanos and an effort to trick him.
Stand completely in place. They don't even do the shell game out of it. He just makes one to the left, one to the right. It's like, my god, we can't tell which one he is.
But the funny thing is, it does turn out to be the one on the left with no actual, like, you don't know how it happens.
But somehow Kane stares him down, which, again, way to establish our protagonist, super intense guy who gets bailed out by an old and firm man. And somehow Kane stares and deduces that because one of them has a bead of sweat running down his nose. I guess it's well established in the Highlander lore that illusions can't sweat. Only a man can. And so he strikes gladly, cuts off Nakano's head, and the quickening begins. Or does it?
Well, it does, and this leads to, again, one of those delightful moments where Nakano, despite having his head severed off, apparently continues to talk, even though there should be no air.
Going, there can only be one.
But
it will not be you.
He's sorcerering.
Yeah, because, he brings the whole cave down on Kane, and Connor escapes, and then we jump in.
Also, why did we get so much Lorena McKennitt on the soundtrack and not the song Sorcerer by Stevie Nicks?
They couldn't afford it.
Streets of Fire could afford it, David.
Streets of Fire was a Universal production made by competent people. Let's not forget that as well.
Okay, go back to our archive, listen back to that, and tell me if you still think so.
Point of being here that, yes, we then jump ahead to 1994, where Connor McLeod is now adopted a son, John! Here, this will eventually become important for reasons.
Don't we first jump to Tokyo, Japan?
Yes.
That is clearly Montreal.
Yeah, it's the mountains of Montreal where, in this instance, Dr. Alex Johnson from the museum in New York City has come here to...
museum!
Do they even really say where she's from? Does it even matter?
I don't think so. That's the tier we're operating in, this Val.
Yep.
I'm a historical researcher. I'm from the museum. I'm here to analyze the sample you found.
And what gets even better is, she walks into this sort of hydro plant where they apparently, they've come across this collapsed cave where they're finding artifacts there. And sure enough, we get a scene where she's getting filled in on the details there. She gets guided her view up to the boardroom full of Japanese executives who are all just staring down at her. And of course, she bows to them and they bow to her because, of course, this is...
No, she's a girl boss.
So,
Dave, it's 1994. The glass ceiling got shattered a long time ago.
Not where I was going with this. But putting that aside here, sure enough, this happens. But while this is going on, we discover that, Connor McLeod is, yes, Morocco, has a son named John, and has a friend by the name of Jack Donovan. Now, the only reason I bring up Jack Donovan
is that why are you bringing this up?
Because he's played by Michael Jaston. Now, Michael Jaston will probably mean nothing to most of you. However,
he was tied to Doctor Who. I read IMDb.
Yes, he was. He is, yes. He played the Valyard, an evil potential incarnation of the Doctor between their 13th and or their 12th and final regeneration, wherever that may be. Point of the matter is,
well, the same
is he dressed like
Kane
a trash can
is,
too?
Sorry?
Yeah, Kane is analogous because he is also an evil doppelganger appearing between iterations of an established franchise. Also, speaking of doppelgangers, my daughter, who is 9 years old, asked me while out for a walk the other day, "Dad, do you have a doppelganger?"
Oh.
Kids.
And? Do you?
Well, no. I don't believe I do. I then asked the logical question of, how on earth do you know what a doppelganger is?
What was the answer?
I don't know. I just heard it somewhere. So I mean, sometimes understanding kids requires you to take the Highlander 3 approach.
Mm-hmm.
Just go with the vibe. And in
Fair
this
enough.
Case, yeah, we see the vibe of, the friend of Connor, who literally, is it a Mary performance in the sense that they have one scene in person and then one of them on the telephone and that's it?
Yep, exactly. So, but what ends up happening here basically is, yes, meanwhile, back in Japan in the middle of the night, Kane and his two other immortal henchmen get out of the cave. And in the process, again, if you're listening to one version of the film, he says, McLeod owes me for 400 years, as opposed to all those years. You tell me which one makes more sense. I don't care. Point being here that, yes, he tells one of his henchmen to go find the Highlander. And as soon as he's walking away, Kane turns around and decapitates his other follower, which really shouldn't be much of a surprise when you consider that based upon the rules of this, there should now only be four immortals left. Kane doesn't seem like he's the kind of the one to want to give up on the prize here. But what makes this baffling is a number of points because, okay, so what we're basically asked to believe is that Connor won the prize in 1986, but apparently because of this magic cave, this was basically like the penalty box, where it's like, no, you're out of the game. You don't belong here for now.
Yeah.
And now the game's back on
to
because they
be fair, that cave was under a lot of rocks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, exactly.
That's enough to void the rules of Highlandry.
Apparently. So yeah, so that happens, and sure enough the next day
more importantly, bodies are left.
Yes,
because when they're investigating the following day the mysterious break-in, they realize somebody killed a security guard and somebody killed a guy wearing 16th century Japanese battle dress.
Yeah.
And we get that incredible bit though where it's like, that's a pretty authentic looking copy. Deborah Kerr Unger stares down, looks up, and says with the steadfast confidence only a professional could deliver, "I don't think it's a copy."
It's something about the way it's her lip movement. I don't know what it is about her delivery of that line. It's just so weird how she performs it.
Because it's a terrible line.
It's a terrible line, but it's like she's putting some weird...
But it's delivered like it's the coolest line in the world, and in so doing, you have to admire the confidence. I also like, though, that, again, signaling what kind of level this film is at, she is able to then confirm that it's 400 years old by looking at a slide of something underneath a microscope and seeing a couple of fibers and saying, "It is 400 years old. It's not a copy."
She also discovers from a piece of it, there's a piece of tartan cloth there, which implies that,
yes,
there was a Scotsman there in a time when there should have never have been any contact between Scotland and Japan, which puts her on a path. But the point of the matter is...
And eventually she pieces together from these two things the entire lineage of Clan MacLeod, and eventually tracks this the surviving legendary outcasted member of the the Klan to modern day New York. But we have a couple hops to make first.
Yes, because after Kane kills his one follower, we see the sky get that sort of rolling cloud, very obviously added in post effect, where Connor realizes...
There's so much post effects in this. I can't wait to talk about them more.
Oh yeah, but
pudding be thickening and clouds be quickening.
Yeah, so Connor basically realizes like, game's back on. So here,
it really is not the case that there can only be one.
But
I thought I got the prize. I don't want the rest of Sherry.
But Christ, in this instance, Connor, Jesus, Connor turns to good friend Jack. It's like, I need to go to New York for reasons. Please look after my child. Now, why he has to specifically go to New York in this instance, I don't know. Like, why couldn't you?
They also throw in the detail to explain, because Highlanders as immortals are supposed to be sterile. He knows that he's not your real son, doesn't he? Yeah, it was the first thing he knew about me. Not his real dad.
Yes. So, yeah, this will become important very later on, not because of, for necessarily plot purposes, but because of an immortal line uttered by Mario Van Peebles.
A truly immortal line, yes.
But sure enough, Connor decides to be the deadbeat dad that he is, ditch his son, and head off to New York for reasons that are not particularly clear. At the same time, yes, Alex is heading back to New York.
I love how he also doesn't... where the gathering is. Like, wasn't the gathering in New York?
It was in New York, but they never established that it's like, yep, we have to head here at this point in time.
Oh, wait, because they're trying to recreate the first movie beat for beat, and it took place in New York.
Well,
so
yes,
that's where we have to
and
go.
And also... he just sees the sky quicken, right? So he is like, well, I don't know. All I know is somebody else is out there, so I guess I may as well go from Morocco to New York. At the same time, turns out Kane has a similar idea where he says, I'm here in Tokyo, Japan. I, too, will go to New York. And Deborah Kara Unger also says, I got a feeling I need to go to New York. So it's ridiculous, but somehow these three characters independently, they don't actually go there to find one another, but they all end up going there independently, and that causes everything?
Well,
it's tremendous. Also, Connor doesn't own a suitcase because he folds everything into, like, a rucksack.
Well, as we'll discover, this leads to a couple of key points and details. Okay, so first of all, Connor ends up in New York, and the first thing that happens is, because this is New York in the early 90s, and it was the easiest shorthand to establish that New York's a dangerous place.
We got some gangbangers.
Oh, yeah.
Who, for no discernible reason, shoot him up, which is like, okay, this was random. What makes it all the better, though, is the follow-up scene, which makes no sense whatsoever, because, okay, the ambulance drivers bring Connor into the hospital, or at least the corridor that's passing for a hospital.
We got a guy in trauma. He's got two bullet wounds. And then, you know, they're rushing him through. And I think my daughter's born in this hospital. But the doctor eventually leans in. He's like, why are you wasting my time with this? This man is fine. But... and not only have his bullet wounds healed, but so is his shirt.
But what makes it even better is that this... okay, so fine, you would have this moment, but what ends up happening is... and this is all being shot handheld and in a lot of extreme close-ups, I might add.
Yes.
Connor freaks out for reasons.
Yep.
Let me go. I need to go. Why? Why do you need to go get out of here in the sort of rush state?
I don't know where I am, but I don't belong here.
They start wrestling with him, and then the doctor, with no discernible purpose, is like, put him up in the Ward 9, which, yes, yeah.
Well, first they say, though, nurse, get a sedative, which is one of my favorite movie tropes.
Yeah.
Because if somebody is ever out of control, even if they're an immortal being who has just recovered from two point-blank gunshot wounds to the stomach, if you jab them with a syringe full of a mysterious dark fluid, they will be unconscious for as long as the plot requires.
That's true.
Wait, even though the plot really doesn't require any of this. But this is the thing where
that's the chef very kiss extraneous. On this one.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he wakes up in basically the psych ward.
Yeah.
Strapped to the bed and talking to his crazy roommate who thinks he's Napoleon.
I meant to look this guy up because I think he gives my favorite performance in this whole movie.
Oh, it's up there. We haven't even gotten to Martin Neufeld yet.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But yes, so Connor convinces him that he's like one of Napoleon's generals, convinces him to let him out.
Your top soldier. I need to go finish my mission.
Exactly. And Connor decides to escape this very clearly very secure ward, because, yeah, he gets out ASAP, and then goes into basically the laundry area. Now, when we say the laundry area of a hospital, you might assume that it's just like a big room with a bunch of industrial washers in there, right?
Yeah, no, it's the basement from the climax of Commando.
Yeah, they go in there and it's just, you happen to know it's the washer area because there are sheets drawn out on lines across the whole thing. Again, I'm pretty sure industrial dryers were being used in hospitals by this point, but...
Dave, it's a lot better for the fabric to just line dry them. It also conserves energy.
Fair yeah. enough.
Plus, the steam from all the exposed pipes and machinery, it helps give that air-dried feeling indoors.
Yes. Now, however, what it doesn't help with necessarily is bloodstains. But what ends up happening here is Connor, even though he doesn't have his sword at this point, has been tracked down by Kane's other henchmen, who apparently has made his way to New York from Japan without having to once change his clothing to blend in anywhere. And is
And he's walking through the hallway and everyone is freaking out like a nurse sees him and he just shut up.
Yeah.
I guess he picked up colloquial English on the trip as well. And I guess no one saw him until literally the moment he opened this building.
Yeah.
But eventually we get a brief cat and mouse. And then what happens? We get the, where is Kane? Don't worry about Kane. Worry about me.
Yeah, which leads to, yes, we didn't discuss the secret move that Nakano taught Connor, which is basically just grab a guy as he's rushing you and turn the sword around and chop his head off. Which, yeah, does we do get that great delivery from Christopher Lambert of, you've already lost at this point where, yeah. And then, again, more a hand for unnecessary directorial choices. We get a repeated three shot of Connor grabbing his hands and swinging the sword. Then it goes into like a reverse polarization image.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we suddenly have that. And then coming back again for a third time to see the exact same footage before he decapitates this individual. And we get a quickening and Connor gets the hell out of here. Why did this happen? We needed an action beat, apparently.
Well, the same reason, why does Kane have henchmen? So we can have more than 60 minutes of plot to get us through the film.
True. Now, this does, however, lead to the introduction of quite possibly my favorite performance in this film, and quite possibly the best character in this movie, and that is Lieutenant John Sten, played by Martin Neufeld. And this is a man who you can tell he had dedicated all of his energy into, I'm going to play the most hard-bitten New York cop who's seen it all and doesn't take or play by the rules ever. Because he walks in into this frame and is just chewing scenery like nobody's business. And what...
Oh, yeah. He is taking bites out of it. And with the snarl he is putting on, they are sizable bites.
Oh, yeah.
He very much, funny enough, Jay Johnson, the comedian who may or may not have been at the Capitol riot, he had the immortal line on the Sarah Silverman show, as a cop, I've seen things that would make you crap a book on how to puke. The character Jeez. That Martin Neufeld is playing in this film has that kind of hyperbole unironically in his demeanor throughout the film. Like, you get the sense that a single day for him is 8 murders and a whole bunch of guys escaping justice. He is the angriest police officer you have ever seen in a movie.
And the thing is that according to him, he instantly picks up, it's like that Russell Nash, the identity that Connor's been using when he's been in New York. Is this. Now, this led to the younger me before I finally clued into the fact that nobody had a clue what they were doing on these movies. You know, trying to figure out, it's like, oh, was he in the previous movies? And I always assumed there's that scene at the start of the first Highlander, where you see, after Christopher Lambert does the first decapitation, the police have him up against the car, and there's the one cop who says, don't move, don't even breathe. I, for whatever reason, always assumed that that was supposed to be Sten. Like, that was my headcanon. It's like, oh, that was him. This is him years ago.
But because the character shows up with zero background or introduction, and from his first appearance onward, indicates that he's had Russell Nash on his radar for the last 8 years, you, like, that's the only way you could read that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that doesn't actually seem to be the case.
No. I mean, they were two completely different actors, and I think they're credited as different roles, but that was just where young Dave trying to make sense of this went.
But, sorry, sir, they spell and pronounce their last names differently.
Yeah.
What that means, though, is like like almost halfway into the film, the movie drops like a secondary antagonist who, it's one thing to like deploy a villain later in the game. It's another when they show up and be like, by the way, I've been following you all this time and we have a direct history with each other, when they literally have not appeared in the film until now or the film prior.
Yeah. But speaking of things that are being introduced almost halfway through, Connor gets home to his loft, which again leads to my old favorite trope of people who are apparently wealthy enough just to leave apartments completely
unoccupied
furnished.
Almost an entire decade.
Yeah.
And unlocked.
Yeah, apparently. And again, I do love Connor's loft. I mean, it's always been an impressive set. But sure enough, he turns on the TV, and who happens to be on it, being broadcast from Japan? Why none other than Alex, who Connor suddenly freezes and starts realizing, Sarah. And this leads to our flashback to Revolutionary France.
Oh, man.
Yes, we get Christopher Lambert playing the very the quote-unquote Scottish Connor MacLeod in France with a English woman played by Deborah Kara Unger in these flashbacks.
Who is speaking with a British accent in the flashbacks.
Yep. And in a red wig, who apparently they have a passionate romance, which leads to not quite a full-on scene of barn coitus in this instance. Yeah, but it's
the whole... Yeah. But it's... The thing is, as ridiculous as it is, it is compressed into, like, three scenes that are not even like continuous with each other, and I think this aspect of the film takes up no more than like 4.5 minutes of total screen time. But it's there simply so we can establish, I have a lover, your name is Catherine, but I am also part of the revolution. And like, it just drops in the French Revolution, and literally all it has to say about the French Revolution, like, the only understanding that the film demonstrates is, well, in France, there was a revolution.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I would love for there to have been, like, the Les Mis cut of Highlander 3, where...
Yeah. This entire film is the story of Catherine.
Exactly. But
oh no, Javert is after me once again.
Oh look, it's Russell Crowe.
You are not a righteous man.
but in this instance,
I was a gladiator. What happened? It's a welcome change, though. Everyone dunked on him for his singing, but it's nice to see Russell Crowe play someone other than a fat civil servant these days.
There was Jor-El.
Friend of the show, Russell Crowe. Where do you come from? Where did you go?
But yes.
Where were we?
So anyways,
the French Revolution flashback. Yes. Yes, we see a couple scenes of meet-cuting and the proverbial whoopee, until news of the impending revolution means that our man, Connor, has to make a choice.
Yes, and that is, he needs to go and help in the revolution for reasons. I don't know. Heads back to England. But wouldn't you know it, from a later flashback, we'll find out that Connor was apparently captured. And while he's sitting in the jail cell in the middle of a day with many guards around, another immortal who's also friends with Connor basically says, "I'm here to take your place. I'm tired of this life." Knocks Connor out.
I want to die. You are also a great warrior against evil.
Yeah.
And it's like, if this is happening pre or post him meeting Nakano and getting his ass, as they say, handed to him by Kane.
Yeah.
Like, what has he done to earn the status of great warrior against evil? Even in 1994, he's pretty useless against four street thugs.
Yeah.
But in this instance, sure enough, yes, this scheme works because apparently the guards, again, I don't know, are they face blind? Were they just not paying attention? But sure enough, they pull out this not Connor individual who, yes, proceeds to get his head to guillotine.
In your butt, Connor!
Yes. But while not only is Connor staring on, who happens to have also arrived in order just in time to witness not Connor get his head lopped off? Why, none other than Sarah, who is sort of
Catherine.
Horrified. Sorry?
Isn't it Catherine?
Nope, Sarah.
Sarah.
Yeah.
Wait, now I hear Christopher Lambert. Sarah. Okay.
Yeah. So, at any rate,
was Catherine the name of his wife in the first movie?
Yeah, I think it is.
I don't know. Yeah.
But point of the matter is,
I can picture him saying Catherine.
Yeah.
Oh, Catherine. First, I loved Catherine, then I love Sarah.
Yes. So the big thing.
My favorite young male actor is Michael Sarah. This has been Lambert on the movies. Seeing you next time.
Oh my god, this is episode.
Smash that follow button. Jesus.
Oh, so. So Sarah thinks she sees Connor get beheaded.
And sure enough.
It was not me, though. I'm going to go back to the country house. How much time has passed before, like, she has a new man and a child?
We have no idea.
It's like a couple of days, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, a solid weekend.
But,
it's a long weekend.
But point is, Connor shows up, sees them at a distance, and decides, no, I'm not going to interrupt this. Now, never mind that he probably would have found out that if he had gone up to her that, you know, maybe this is her, you know, this is somebody that she has been dating, and this is his daughter in this instance.
Maybe
and,
the kid is holding him hostage.
Yeah, hard to say. Point of the matter is that, yes, we cut back to present day where, yes, we see Kane arriving in New York City, where, yes, he proceeds to use his powers of illusion to win at three card Monty, and then
steals his sunglasses.
Yeah, steals a guy's sunglasses. Still not sure how these powers of illusions quite work, but and so, then sure.
Can I just pause for a second here, Dave?
Sure.
I'm still just and again. Credit to the film. I didn't think about it while watching it, but as we're talking about it, what even was the point of sending his henchmen to New York like a day ahead of him going to New York?
I have
well, you would
no
think
idea.
The logic would be that henchman one finds Connor in New York and reports back. But that scene never happens.
Yeah.
Because he finds Connor literally at the moment he is killed by Connor. And then all of a sudden, Kane is in New York, blending in with the locals.
Yeah, exactly. No, this makes literally
no
sense.
The only thing that this movie was missing was Kane having, like, a gimmicky, uniformed gang of henchmen from the present. Like, a bunch of, like, breakdance fighters or something. That's the only thing this movie is missing.
Now, had this been a canon movie, we can rest assured that that would have happened. But,
Totally.
Yeah. But, in this instance, no, instead, after winning, cheating at three card Monty, Kane ends up, for reasons that are absolutely superfluous to the rest of the film, walks by a shop
he sees Deborah Kara Unger on TV, yeah. And somehow deduces she knows more about this mysterious cave than she lets on.
Yeah. But that's not pressing enough for him not to stop by a little shop in its window and then get, you know, picked up by a pimp for a completely gratuitous, not quite a sex scene, but jokes involving him not understanding what condoms are, because sure, that was completely necessary.
Well, I mean, it does solve the problem of Michael Ironside knowing what sports drafting is.
It doesn't help the problem of understanding how Kane knows how to drive later on in this movie, but we'll get to that later on.
Not very well. That's why he's always crashing into invisible airplanes.
We'll get there. Yeah. So, point of the matter
grief.
Is, yes, eventually, Alex tracks down Connor to a local gym, temple, whatever this place may be. It's never really clearly established exactly what it is, but it does have the falling water motif being kept inside, much like in Nakano's cave.
No, it's his old antique shop, right? But she's asking Mr. Nash if he knows anything about Connor McLeod, the mysterious outcast of the legendary McLeod tribe.
Yes, but she...
And, you know, it's... I don't know who you're talking about. I haven't seen that man in years.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, who walks in? But by God, it's Kane!
Well, this...
Who immediately, hello, McLeod.
But that's the point.
Oh no, my secret identity is exposed.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It doesn't... Christ. But that's the thing. It happens at that temple because they're fighting on holy ground, which is one of the important rules in the Highlander mythos, is that they cannot fight on holy ground, which leads to some subpar Earl Flynn-style antics with Kane and McLeod
swinging on chandeliers.
Yeah, and attacking...
But I also love the line, we cannot fight on holy ground. I'll be the judge. Or, like, what does he say? Like, I guess we'll see about that. What does that even mean?
Andrew, he's a puppet without strings. He can do whatever he wants.
But they clearly can fight on holy ground.
Well.
And indeed, Connor's sword gets shattered. And,
but it's magic, you know? Shattering. It's, like I said, that's the thing. It's not a normal shatter. It's that magic shatter. It's into millions of little pieces, and that's why Kane backs away. Granted, things like Highlander the series did more better things of establishing why you don't fight on holy ground.
Why don't you? Does the Mogwai turn into a gremlin?
No, but they do note that Pompeii was basically the result of it. So...
Oh, that's what you get for fighting on holy ground.
Yeah, so, but not in this thing. It's just, we'll destroy your property. That's the end of it.
Why didn't they destroy Kane's property? Is he more holy than Connor?
Well, who knows? Maybe Connor has got a
it's
real sick
Connor's
history.
It's Connor's apartment.
It's Connor. It's, again.
Or whatever. Yeah, who cares? It's not an apartment.
Okay, point of the matter.
The bottom line is, he needs a new sword. He needs to figure out where to go. What better place than Glasgow, Scotland?
Well, before we get there, we get, of course, Lieutenant Sten interviewing Alex and letting you know, let me let you know about your friend Russell Nash. And let me know that he was married to Brenda 8 years ago, and then they got into a car accident over there in Scotland. She was...
You think he's a nice guy? He was killed instantly, and he walked away from it without a scratch!
Exactly. So you better keep that in mind, who you're dealing with here. And Alex...
Smoking three cigarettes at the same time.
Yeah.
This guy's dangerous. You stay away from him. You hear me?
Exactly. But sure enough, yes, she goes to see Nash, overhears in his apartment where she listens in as he's booking a ticket to go to Scotland.
Because the airline is thankfully and graciously confirming that his tickets have been placed at the counter.
Yes.
Also, we completely skipped over the fact that the reason that she ends up coming to New York, we do have a reason. Someone sends her a fax of a headline reading "Headless Body Fan."
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And so she takes it upon herself to investigate an unsolved crime from 8 years ago
in New York, instead of working in her Japanese historical laboratory excavating mysterious.
Andrew,
cave.
It's called the museum.
Oh yes, a museum's work is never done.
But the important,
and in this case, yeah, she happens to have a little bar of iron.
Yeah, she does. Yes, the
from the cave.
That's right.
That happens in Scotland.
Well, she has it with her before she goes to Scotland, but it's the one that Nakano used to sharpen his sword back then. So,
guys, I cannot believe how detailed we're getting into Highlander 3 and how good your memories are.
I love it. It's especially great because, like, see this iron? Yeah, can't find it anywhere else. It literally exists nowhere else on Earth.
But
this chunk of metal.
Yeah, well, this does...
Without me, you could not have made a sword, I guess.
Well, this is where it gets even better, because, okay, Connor presumably owns other swords that he could use, but apparently his reason for going to Scotland is so he can go to...
maybe he sold them to pay the rent on the loft apartment.
Could be. But he ends up going to Scotland to his, you know, to his home estates there, back from what, you know, when he was first born. And he finds, apparently, the tools for sword making that he buried under a rock hundreds of years ago, because...
It's barely buried, so, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he knows how to make swords, he's just not good at fighting with them.
So, but yeah, he starts trying to build a new sword, but it just isn't working. Until Alex arrives with Nakano's little piece. And sure enough, we get this montage of beautiful Scottish...
It turns out the real Nakano was inside of me all along.
but yes.
It's from a different cut of the movie.
Yeah, it's just like you almost... It's the equivalent of the upbeat 80s sports montage, except we get Lorena McKennitt singing Canada's Own. We get her singing, like, authentic Scottish ballads, while we get a montage of shirtless Christopher Lambert making a sword and shirtless Christopher Lambert standing on a cliff practicing sword moves.
Well, he isn't quite shirtless. There's actually a very nice gray sweater that he's wearing in this instance, with a bit of a turtleneck.
The vampire Lestat.
Yeah, but sure enough, yes, he does this, and this ultimately leads to a thing where, you know, we have this sort of discussion where Alex.
They have the talk where he confesses that he's Connor McLeod, which she acts shocked by. And it's like, didn't you already literally see that be revealed in front of you previously?
Well, she's not shocked by it, because she quite straight up tells him, it's like, I know who you are. You're Connor McLeod of the Clan McLeod, born in the Lochs of, and goes through his whole history. And then he finishes up by saying, and I cannot die. They lock lips, and then it leads into probably the most infamous scene and the one that most people will remember from this film.
Now, James, you did some interesting research and you found out some interesting stuff about this scene.
I did. The Internet Movie Database trivia section helpfully points out that Deborah Kerr Unger chose to do this scene without a body double.
Yeah. I think it's an organicism that really makes this scene palpably erotic. I think it's very tasteful. I think the visual sight of Deborah Kerr Unger and Christopher Lambert having passionately erotic sex, I think it's tasteful and not awkward. And I think it holds up really well. It
reminds me, like... how, like, there's like a handful of actors that should not be in sex scenes. Christopher Lambert's one. The other one is Scott Glenn from Christopher Walken or Scott Glenn from The Keep, which is another, like, wholly misguided. Like, this is erotic.
Donald Sutherland in Don't Look Now as well. And yeah. Like, I don't know, that mustache.
But I will say, this is where you see Morahan's music video background come out in full.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, like,
it wants to be the Take My Breath Away scene in Top Gun so badly. But instead we get something a bit closer to 9.5 weeks.
Yeah.
Or we get something, we get something closer to literally every other 90-minute action movie from this era. Yeah. Where at between the 1 hour and 1 hour and 10 minute mark, we got to stop to have a sex scene.
Yeah, and like Terminator does that with Linda Hamilton and Michael Biehn.
Livewire with Pierce Brosnan and Lisa Ellerbacher.
Yep, and the Thomas Crown Affair. There are thousands of great examples, and the Thomas Crown Affair is the best of them. Indeed, it probably is the best movie of all time, but that's another talk for another day. The point is, it's just like, it's one thing to have like A-list actors doing like the brave, palpable sex scene. There is something decidedly tackier about what we see here.
Oh, well, yeah.
This is, I will say this, it is absolutely shameless in what it aims to do. So, I mean, on one part, it's like, well, nobody's pretending that the scene is in this movie for any other reasons than what it is. The other thing I will say is, at the very least, this was probably, you know, Jennifer Unger practice to get ready for David Cronenberg's Crash. So keep that in mind, folks. That's all I'm going to say there. But, yeah, so...
If it helps, I could make engine noises.
Oh, oh God. Yeah, another Canadian film with Elias... that's what this film needed, Elias Koteas, in this movie as well.
Fill me up with oil. You're my mechanic.
Boy.
I am driving 60 kilometers per hour.
Anyways, moving on from the scene. Okay, so this has happened, and unless you were in the United States seeing this in a theater in 1994, in which case, or 95, in which case you didn't get to see the scene until video. Point is, it's done. We then move to Yes Them. Again, talking or over in a little Scottish pub, enjoying the night.
It's like the most Scottish pub that was ever Scottish.
Yeah, and while they're in there, lo and behold, a call comes from Connor, coming from his good friend, Jack Donovan. Now, if you've forgotten about...
Now, how does Jack know that he's in Glasgow?
Don't know!
Let alone this specific tavern.
Who? No, I just imagine like the sequence of events of him just like,
Connor, where are you? You're supposed to pick up your boy at the airport.
Well, that's the thing, because, okay, so yeah, two things. One, Kane broke into Connor's apartment in New York, overheard the phone call from his boy being left there, which inspires Kane, yes, to convince or fake a situation where, yes, John will come to New York and end up in Kane's hands. But putting that aside, number one, first of all, Connor, you deadbeat dad. Wouldn't it make sense to at least let everybody know where you are at any given point in time?
Well, evidently he had to have.
You would think so, but
it's
I just find it far more amusing to imagine Jack just like, okay, I've got this address book of all the bars and places that Connor likes to go around the world. I am just going to start calling them one at a time, and we'll see if I luck out.
Lay off, Jack. I am going to live forever. You know how many kids I've adopted?
But, having heard this from Jack, Connor says that, yes, I'm going to go, yes, I'll pick him up in New York. Which, again, can Connor get a flight at this time of day to make it to New York in time to do this? Somebody who knows travel schedules.
He can, just 30 seconds after his son's flight arrives.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. So, yeah. So, number one, putting aside this also, forgets the thing, is like, doesn't Alex have a job she's supposed to be working as well? Like, did she get use vacation time to come out and follow this up? Who knows? But yes, Connor rushes back to America, which leads to an era of airport security that no longer exists, where Connor is able to shove his way through and run along the baggage carriers there to make his way to try and track his son. And James, you notice a wonderful little detail about this very New York airport.
This is one of like the greatest details, and I can, like, when the episode's up, I'll make sure that I post this picture. But, like, the previous scene is, what's the kid's name? John?
John, yeah.
John comes to New York, and she hands him his passport and says, "Welcome to New York, Mr. McLeod." And, like, almost the next shot is a beautiful overhead. You're looking at the, I guess, an upper level, and there's a gigantic sign that says, "Bienvenue à Montreal," which is only partially obscured by an American flag.
Yeah, very partially. So yes, sure enough, yes, John is picked up by what he thinks is his dad, which is of course Kane. Connor isn't able to get there
using his illusion too.
Using his illusion powers, yes. And meanwhile, while Connor's trying to escape, who happens to arrest him at the airport? Why, none other than John Sten. What is charge that he picking him up on? I have no idea. But,
suspect.
Cutting a bunch of people's heads off in 3 years.
Yeah, so we get this.
Now he's the Macho Man Randy Savage, apparently.
But apparently, yes, this leads to this weird parallel cutting between Connor in the interrogation room where Sten is just, like, shouting things at him, and Connor basically is just like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what's going on. I'm admitting nothing. And sure enough,
if you're going to charge me, then charge me. Otherwise, you'll have to let me go.
Yeah, and then meanwhile...
Oh, he's got us!
Yeah, and then we get the recreation of the Brenda getting driven around by the Kurgan from the first movie. Only this time, it's Mario Van Peebles' Kane terrorizing a small boy with the powers of illusion and driving like a maniac. Which, again...
And laughing exactly like Freddy Krueger.
Exactly.
It's that territory of... Wah-ha-ha! And, like, making horrid puns and just laughing while terrorizing a youth. You don't see that in films anymore.
No, you don't.
No. What you also don't see in films these days is getting called to meet up at apparently just a church that's randomly open in the middle of the day of a weekday or something. Where, yes, Connor ends up after being let go by Sten, thus ending the whole plot line involving the police that is never capped off whatsoever. Yep. And I'm pretty sure Sten's dialogue is being all completely dubbed in. Because, again, we only see him from the back at this point. We never get a close-up on his face at all from this point forward. But yes, Connor tracks down Kane to what he thinks is at this church for an exchange. And sure enough, when John's running up to Connor, he disappears because he himself is an illusion. Which leads to, oh my god, this monologue from Mario Van Peebles, which, again, is among the highlight reel of this movie, where he starts explaining about how...
Yeah, because Connor is mad that he uses illusions. He is a deceiver. To which Kane points out that, well, Connor himself is a master of deception in his own way.
Yeah, because how is it that you convinced all those women that they couldn't have children when it was really your euphemism for the penis that really couldn't do the pecking in this instance? And yeah,
David, come on!
What?
I don't know. He, as he says, when it was really your pecker that wasn't doing the pecking, which is such a strange way to phrase male infertility, mm-hmm. that it just immediately hops off of the screen into your ear and buried into your heart and brain forever. Much like the quickening does with the knowledge of the man you just killed.
Yeah, but Kane disappears into an illusion, and then Connor realizes that apparently he's at the factory that's next door, that's abandoned. Yep,
apparently it's like a power plant.
Yeah, he got them on, you know, a holiday, nobody's around, they're just letting the whole place run on autopilot, apparently. Who knows? But yes, Connor wanders into this, and this leads us to, again... this showdown, which, number one, I love the orange overlit lighting and steam that's happening all over the place. And sure enough, mm-hmm. this is where our big final confrontation between Connor and Kane is going to take place, much to the sound of a rock soundtrack at this point, including a riff
legally distinct.
Yeah.
Sample of Dr. Feelgood for literally like 4 measures, and then it switches to something else.
Yeah, it's just like and then
yeah, exactly,
something else. It's driving me nuts.
Yeah,
I couldn't place it, Andrew, until you texted that.
But that's
I do come in handy here and there. But I mean, you get your very standard pacing for the scene. Music video editing with punctuated by them clashing swords, getting real close, and then saying a pithy 1-2 with each other mm-hmm. of, you know, I'll be the one to take the prize from you. You will never live long enough to wield it, action scene. And then eventually...
Mm-hmm. I'll see you in hell. I'll be the judge of that.
Which doesn't really speak to the point, but it culminates with Connor victorious, guided by the power of love and paternal irresponsibility, ends up decapitating Kane. He truly has won the prize.
But not before this film ended up ripping off Terminator 2 with, yes, Connor, you know, impaling a disguised Kane as Alex here, which, looks, it's a straight lift from T2 with the Linda Hamilton calling up to John. Gee, I wonder why they took the name of that for Connor's child in this movie. But yes, sure enough, the film ends with them back.
She's not a robot. She's a sorcerer. There's a clear and legal difference.
but sure enough, we end up back in Scotland, where Connor notices, I have a son. I've got a woman who loves me. I'm driving off into the sunset. It is, and depending upon the version...
I am Razor Ramon.
And depending upon what version of the movie you're watching, this will either end with more beautiful sort of Celtic sounding music or a rock song of some sort. There is, again, it's one of those cues that's a little bit different depending upon which region you're seeing.
What rock song would it be? Because I got Lorena McKennitt again.
Yeah, I also got Lorena McKennitt. What is it? It's, I looked
it
up. I'm
trying to think. Kim Mitchell, Lager and Ale. Yeah, I think it would fit. Great tonal match, this shot of woman's grave. See this woman's grave? That's someone I used to be in love with. Well, let's go home. Yeah, so I guess we're supposed to take that presumably Connor's mortal now, but we don't really know. Instead, we get the grave, and we get a family about to misbehave.
And then
that's the end of the movie.
Yeah.
In the U.S. version of the film, the Sues, DeMarchi, and Nuno Bettencourt rock song God Took a Picture plays over the final credits. Nuno Bettencourt, guitarist of the band Extreme.
Oh, wait, I know that song. Look at this photograph. When I was
left. Oh, God. But yeah, so that's Highlander 3. And yeah, there is nothing to this movie at all. There's no subtext. There's no paratext. There's nothing to this movie.
This is a film that's designed to work on a purely surface level.
Yeah.
And in that respect, though, they absolutely delivered on that premise.
I mean, to an extent, I'll agree with you. Like, this is, and my favorite Highlander film is the second one because it's bonkers disasterness, right? Like, it's so, like, in its own misguided way, ambitious, and it is too big for its britches, plus every other conceivable thing that went wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas this movie is just as dumb. Like, it's it is no more or less misguided than pretending they're aliens from another planet. But, like, some of it I just don't find... I don't know.
There's less audacity in the vision for what this film is. And I think it's more the sense that the second one was like, let's really do it. Let's do it. Let's blow up the Highlanderverse. Let's make, like, an actual space opera franchise out of it. Whereas here, it's like, let's do the first one, but a little bit different.
But shorter.
So there's a much more narrow focus. And I get that there's something more interesting, I guess, about the scope of the second one, even though in terms of watchability, I think the third one is the better bet.
Yeah, I'm going to be with James. Like, personally, I say, if we're legitimately, the first Highlander is still a good film. I will say if you're looking for a...
It's mostly okay.
Yeah.
It's very much of its time, but it's not a bad movie.
Yeah, and like I said, but in terms of which sequel is the far more entertaining one, I'm with James on this one, because like Highlander 2 is just another level of lunacy. Plus, I there are elements of that film I actually quite like. Stuart Copeland's score is quite enjoyable. One Dream by... Lou Graham is actually a pretty listenable track. I mean, there's plenty.
I think the cinematography is far better on two than we would get here.
Oh yeah, like I mean, like this is
because that movie, because that like while the ambition of this movie is to recreate Highlander 1, the second one, like Highlander 2, has the gall enough to like try and rip off Blade and David Lynch's Dune in terms of its look.
Yeah.
I'm also a sucker for like aesthetic, like dystopian future aesthetic, so.
Yeah.
And well, exactly. And I mean, I fully appreciate that. And like, especially, it's also the difference between making the second film in a franchise versus making the third one. And I think they're kind of by design. I mean, it's not like they weren't aware of Highlander 2 when they were making this. And so I think there's very much a response in the form of scaling things down. And it does make the film, like, much less interesting to unpack on a scene-by-scene basis. At the same time, though, it moves at a brisk clip. And I guess it sort of strikes me as, like, a preference to Batman Forever versus Batman and Robin, where it's like, okay, 2 probably is aiming for more. It certainly has a lot more thought put into it and things like that, whereas this is a much more superficial film, but everybody seems to be on the same page. And while Christopher Lambert has that like bizarre earnestness to everything he does, like, It feels like this film is more tonally unified as well, because there's no real attempt to be brooding or serious or talk about the environment or it's have true. Any kind of big messaging or anything. Like, this strikes me, number 2 is fascinating, and one day we'll get back to looking at that film properly, but again, this is a film that delivers on what it wants to do, and I feel like for the most part, it succeeds with narrow goals, whereas number 2 fails spectacularly while aiming for the moon.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, you know, this is not a film that wastes your time. It moves at such a brisk clip, I think, because most of the significant scenes are really just shot and timed like music videos mm-hmm. as well. So even though this film is dumb, it is not dull. And again, going back to the beginning, I think that's honestly a big part of why I think I was a lot more positive on this film than I was expecting to be, because it's also an hour and 40 minutes. Something is happening in every scene. And I mean, I haven't seen Highlander 2 since we watched it, but I remember it feeling a bit more sedate than this one does.
I suppose.
At the end of the day, if I have to watch a bad movie, I'll at least have the one that's kind of entertaining and moves along at a good clip. All that being said, this is a terrible movie that makes no sense, and there is something decidedly amateurish about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And things which may or may not have been legally actionable happened on the set. So who knows what can or cannot be said about this.
Yes, but it's proof that, you know, I mean, as David was saying about Highlander fans, you know, there's no accounting for taste, and there's no accounting to which aspects of overall geekdom and cult culture that one will truly grab onto. My advice to you is learn from Connor McLeod's Life of Isolation. And grab onto that which you love and hold dear, for you never know when it'll be over, much like this episode probably needs to be. So gentlemen, do we have any final thoughts on Highlander 3 the Sorcerer, aka Highlander the Final Dimension, aka Highlander the Final Conflict, aka Highlander 3 the Magician?
I have no final thoughts.
I have a final thought. The Sorcerer is the better title out of all of those ones. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I mean, The Sorcerer is the most accurate.
Probably Highlander Beyond the Third Dimension. Probably could have made Cracked 40 at the box with that title. But you're right, Dave. You are sticking to it. And now it's our turn to stick it to the film with our patent-pending bumper segment, Heads and Bets, where we celebrate and condemn the little things. Dave, what is your first hit for Highlander 3, The Sorcerer?
First hit in this instance,
a.k.a. Highlander 3, Third Dimension.
A.k.a.
Yes.
All right. Dave, what's your first hit?
To go a little bit off more usual book here, the poster/cover art for the DVD of this film.
Ooh.
I actually really like the poster they put together of this one, which is Connor mid-quickening, hand raised in the air, this little semicircle going around while the explosions in the factory are behind him, while the dates from various different points in history are sort of superimposed. Oh, yes, I'm looking at
now, 1789, 1995, 1642.
1587 and 350 AVJC. So, yes, in this instance...
You sunk my battleship.
Indeed. But I mean, look, let's be clear here. I mean, the most of the poster artwork for the Highlander films is pretty bad. This one's pretty okay. So somebody was doing their job right on this movie. I salute them for my first hit. What about you, James?
I'm gonna do a pair here for my first hit and my first pit. Okay. I'm going to give it to Mario Van Peebles and his performance as Kane, which I can't believe we haven't talked about even after almost 2 hours of talking about Highlander 3. It is pitched at such a bizarre note that, like, mm-hmm. I don't know what he's going for. Like, he's talking really quickly and quietly sometimes and at, like, a measured pace. But then he does, like, it's just, like, I don't even know.
Terrorizing a child in a car for fun. Laughing uproariously. And using illusion to steal sunglasses.
It's wild, and I know it's, like, completely patterned after the other two villains from the other two Highlander films, who are both names start with the letter K.
Yeah.
So, I know exactly what, like, he's given the exact same notes to play as two other better actors, I'm sorry to say. But, so, I don't know. Like, at the same time, it's very campy and not campy enough.
I think he walks a fine line, but I think he ends up walking on the right side of it. Whereas I would say Christopher, like, Lambert it walks a similar line, but he steps onto the wrong side of it.
I will go to bat for Mario Van Peebles in this one. I mean, yeah, he's basically given a do-nothing role, and his basic approach is, well, I gotta try and one-up the previous
It's not a do-nothing role, it's the best character in the movie.
No. That's Sten, okay?
No. Okay, Sten does not use the power of illusion he took from Mako to win at Three Card Monte.
Fair.
It's the Joker and the Riddler at the same time.
I see. I will say...
Sten is but one man.
Just wait until we get to Highlander Endgame and we get to see Bruce Payne as Jacob Kell, the villain.
Here comes the pain.
Yeah, if you want to say that you see bad campy performances, you ain't seen nothing yet here, folks. But yeah, it is. Yeah, I can see where you're coming from on that one, James. I think he's kind of very much in line with what the tone of this movie is, and the fact that, you know, he didn't get, apparently, you know, personally, I'm quite happy they kept him over getting Guns N' Roses for this one, so...
Yeah, hear, hear. Same way that, you know, Russell Mulcahy, maybe Andrew What's-His-Name isn't as statured, but sometimes you end up trading up when you think you're taking a loss. And speaking of taking a loss, sorry, James, 2-1, Mario Van Peebles is a hit. You get another turn, don't you worry. But first, it's my turn. I'm going to give it to Gilles Aird and Ben Morahan, who are the production designers on this film. Obviously, it's very cheap. Obviously, they're making Montreal into New York and Tokyo. A lot of the scenes are filled in nondescript big buildings. But honestly, I think the entire look of this film is unified in, like, a holistic sense, where the same way that it's that weird VHS grain to the image, where this is a film that... I'm not going to pretend that it looks like, say, something shot on 35 or, it's not Antonioni here. But given the fact that in terms of being able to make the most of what you have, I think it's a film that ends up having a pretty flashy look, is able to use space well, and, like, in terms of using a limited pool of resources to pull off a slick look that is constant throughout the film, kudos to those cats for pulling it off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would give my second hit to that that team as well, including cinematographer. Actually, I think there's two cinematographers on this film. But like again, like that, like this has such a very aesthetic, a very choice aesthetic, I'll say. Yeah. And for the third week in a row, and you'll have heard me say this, I am a sucker for Canadian genre films, right? Like this movie looks so Canadian, even like beyond like using obvious Canadian landmarks like the Trudeau Airport in Montreal.
Yeah, this feels like something that could easily be serialized into the magazine Heavy Metal in a certain way. Like there's something very in that similar vein, Metal Hurlant, about Highlander 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like right down to also the, just to backtrack to solidify my point here, using like hilarious post effects like we talked about before, which is done, it's deployed a few times in this movie where like they flip the polarization or like the image color and stuff like that. Stuff that didn't look cutting edge at the time and certainly didn't age well with every passing year.
Yeah.
But it works for me. I don't know.
Damning with faint praise.
Yeah.
Dave, speaking of faint praise, what's your final hit, if you have one, for Highlander 3, The Sorcerer?
I'm actually going to give it to J.
A.K.A.
J. Peter Robinson, who did the music for the film. I actually really like the score for this movie. I mean, it's nothing to write home about in the grand scheme of things, but it does its job well enough. And again, when it really needs to sort of kick into a higher gear for some of the quote-unquote action scenes throughout this film, you know, it does a serviceable job. Likewise, the
Well, he is the one they call Dr. Pretty All Right.
Yeah.
The soundtrack is fairly nondescript, but it gives most of the scenes like a good sort of pulse tempo.
Yeah.
And again, that sort of keeps a lot of the scenes from feeling like they overstay their welcome. The music is good at imparting a sense of, all right, this is going somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, occasionally it's sort of faux operatic approach at times. I mean, it's campy, but I'm okay with that level of camp.
It punctuates the emotions that it needs to punctuate.
It's important to listen to the music, like the notes that they're not playing.
We're just going to stop you right there. Andrew, what's your final hit for this one?
You guys ever think about the jam sessions they must have in heaven? Oh, man. I don't know. Moving on. James, what's your first pit?
Well, I gave my first pit. It was
what's your second pit?
I don't even know. Like,
what's your third pit?
The screenplay by, who's it, Brad Mehrman and
Paul Ohl.
Yeah. Yes. Mehrman, as you've noted, Dave, also co-wrote Night Moves. He also wrote another three or four.
Arthur Penn?
No, sorry. That's the capital. That's K-N-I-G-H-T. Night Moves from 1992. Christopher Lambert starring thriller, which is amazing.
Now, Mehrman was also famous as a half-man, half-aqueous beast.
Because, like, this is a nothing movie, and the screenplay, like, barely even, like, hangs itself together, like, right down to some, like, nonsensical exchanges. Like,
well, the film makes a lot more sense if you put the plot in chronological order, and this film is, like, non-linear for no real reason.
It's non-linear because the first one is non-linear. It mimics the structure, and like, right down.
It's a Miramax film from the 1990s.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a bad screenplay.
It is.
Yeah, it's pretty lousy. Dave, do you have any specific pits for Highlander 3, The Sorcerer?
I'm just going to say the overall production, because when you had Deborah Unger being this brave for this movie, and nothing justifies that, I mean, that's you're letting her down quite a bit here, okay? She deserves
it. I really believe in Highlander 3.
So, but that's all I've got. What about you, Andrew?
I mean, what else is there to say? It's the third Highlander movie, and I think if we talk about it much more than that, I mean, obviously it's always a hoot when we get to do a plus size one to celebrate an anniversary. But at the same time, I think if I've learned one thing across these 150 now episodes, the important thing is to know when to speak and when to let it go. And sometimes it's okay to just enjoy things and not overthink it. It's also important not to give things a pass when they don't deserve it. I was going somewhere with that. The point is, I think we all learned something about ourselves when we came together and watched Highlander 3, The Sorcerer. And I think that's because we realized that, yeah, it's ultimately up to us to find our own prize within. In doing the act of criticism, we must confront the eternal and immortal enemy that we see ourselves as reflected on the screen. And some of us may strike him down. Some of us may behead him and quicken his powers away. Some of us will turn our faces and run for the hills and pretend that we never saw them at all. It is truly up to us. But make your choice wisely, for indeed, there can only be one. And with that, Dave, where are we going next episode of Film Strips?
Well, if you weren't sick of listening to Christopher Lambert impersonations this episode, if we got a doozy for you next week.
I know I wasn't.
Exactly, because we're going to jump back to 1987, a year after the original Highlander, to see how Christopher Lambert tried to capitalize on the white-hot success of that movie by starring in Michael Cimino's adaptation of Mario Puzo's The Sicilian. Yes.
Can everyone's favorite French Scotsman tackle the role of an Italian accent?
Well,
the critic early bettors are saying, Mamma Mia, that's a no.
Yeah, but it does also give us a Terrence Stamp, a Josh Ackland, John Turturro, all in the exact same movie. So, I mean...
Oh, man.
Yeah. So, be prepared from the director who helped bring down United Artists. It's The Sicilian.
Was this his comeback movie?
I'm trying to remember whether... I think he did Year of the Dragon with Mickey Rourke first.
Oh, that's right, he did.
Yeah. So, yeah.
That movie's aged
sure
very
well.
Well,
I'm sure we'll get into that next week, because I often find myself thinking, whatever happened to Michael Cimino? Dave and I have often talked about the Hollywood Renaissance, and indeed, Michael Cimino's an interesting figure, as we will get into, who... much like Icarus, or say Connor McLeod before him, rose to meteoric heights. And okay, you guys can interrupt me at any point now. That being said, we are following to The Sicilian. That's going to be something, if it's anything like this one. And I don't know about you, gang, but that sounds like the most fun thing ever. And I'll be sure to tune in. In the meantime... Dave, where can people get in touch with you on social media?
The Highlander fans can yell at me at 24 panels. Again, look, I'm one of you, sort of, kind of. not really. But the point of the matter is I've spent...
Dave, you've seen Highlander Endgame probably more than once. You're a fan.
All right, yeah, I watched...
You can only see it more than once.
I also saw the theatrical cut, the producer's cut, and the work print edition of it. Yes, I did.
Dave, don't tell on yourself.
So, okay, fine. Point of the matter is, that's where you can reach me. James, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at J_Rivnak, H-R-I-V, N-A-K, the H is silent. You can also find me on Letterboxd under the same username.
And Dave, welcome people getting to talk with you on social media. Just kidding. I'm going to do it Gordon Ramsay style. Twitter, film stripper, email, filmstrippodcast@gmail.com. Rate, review, iTunes, podcatcher, 5 stars, feedback.
Yep.
Well played.
Indeed.
Creme fraiche. John Dory. Yeah. It has been an exciting ride these 3 years of doing film strips. What began as David saying, hey, want to? And me saying, all right, this will be good for a couple of weeks. Maybe I'll see an interesting movie. And so we cap off 150 episodes proper The only way we really know how, and that's having fun talking to our friend James about movies everyone else forgot.
Indeed.
So thank you, James, for being here with us. And thank you to each and every one of you who have stuck it out with us as we continue to learn and bloom and grow and get very tired and disassociate. sometimes it works, sometimes it don't. Much like the Highlander franchise, but also much like the Highlander franchise film strips, there can only be one, and you're listening to it.
All right. You know, I was thinking, Dave, Andrew, if Christopher Lambert were here, I think he would say, Andrew, do you have any parting words for us?
Why, yes, I do, my good friend Christopher Lambert. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Just don't count on Lieutenant John Sten to actually catch your killer. Bye.
Monotony can't kill a Highlander.
Unless it cuts its head off.
Oh, no! Thank you.